From Courtside the Virtual Hardwood, it's the NLSC Podcast, episode number 342. Andrew with you once again. I am the lead content creator and head janitor at the NLSC. My co-host is Derek, also known as Deeper3.
Happy to be here again, as always.
Glad to get on here and talk to you with about basketball gaming, as always, Derek. And we're not alone this week.
I'm super excited. We've had Josh and Dave from Basketball Classics on the show before. Been looking forward to getting them on here again. So, yeah, this is super exciting. Can't wait for the discussion.
And, you know, it's the third time that Josh and Dave have been on here. And you know what they say, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Come on the NLSC podcast three times, it's really your fault. But we are happy to have them here. Looking forward to having a great discussion about basketball gaming today and learning a bit more about the latest in basketball classics, a game we love. Josh and Dave, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much. This is a ton of fun, always.
It's good to hear. Loved having you on the show and talking about hoops, real and virtual. But so tell us, what's been going on in the world of basketball classics? We talked to you earlier this year, but it's been a few months, crazy months indoors and with social distancing and whatnot. But how's it going with basketball classics?
Yeah, it's been a while. Things have been crazy with COVID. Haven't honestly been able to devote quite as much time as we'd have liked to these last few months. But we do have a couple of big features coming pretty soon here. Dave's started working on a new roster. We've got a new 2020 roster on the way, and that will coincide with our big roster editing feature. So we can rename teams, swap color schemes, rename players, give them headbands, change their hair color, make them bald, give them a beard, do pretty much whatever you want. Have your way with these little pixelated dudes.
Yeah, it's the prototype's already going. It's Josh has done a lot of amazing work. I think it still keeps the charm of the pixels, but it adds the customization that so many people have been asking for. So I think it's a great first step into this area.
That is really cool news. And Derek, you know, you've been editing the 2K21 rosters, but now you've got to switch gears.
Oh, I just want to tell you how exciting that is and how much I wish that other companies that make sports games did this. And the biggest reason is because I think Josh and Dave, you both know how big modding is on the PC, how being able to create custom rosters, put your own personal stamp on the game, share those rosters too if you want, etc., how big of a deal that is, and how people on console sorely miss out because they don't have the same abilities. So the fact that more sports games should be doing this and making the base game, not you on PC using extra tools, manipulation and all that stuff, making the core game, the default game, have that customization ability so people on console and PC alike can enjoy those features. I just think it's so huge, and I really hope that more sports games move in that direction. So the fact that you guys are adding that and being proactive in doing that, I think that's really cool, and I think you're going to help people create a lot of memories with the games by being able to do it.
Agreed.
Thank you. I think a lot of people are going to have fun with it. We're excited.
Yeah, it's crazy because you guys have to do, modding, when it's not meant to be modded and then you have to do all these workarounds, people still, life finds a way.
No doubt. Now, and of course, this is going to be $50 DLC, right? Something this cool?
$58.99.
Oh, reasonable. Yeah.
Yeah.
As long as you didn't move into the whole microtransaction area and make us like open packs and for all these gambling mechanics in there, I think we'll be fine.
There's a new currency system. In order to like buy a headband and stuff, there's going to be
classic bucks.
Yeah, what could I make up here? No, I'm just kidding. No, we have it. First off, I don't know if we could do that. Go back to like an economy based kind of thing like that.
Hey, EA's done it with plenty of games.
Yeah, let's start with our microtransactions and we'll work forward from there.
I mean, are you even developers these days if you're not trying to milk us for every cent we have? I mean, come on, guys. What do you think this is, 2005? Treating customers like, you know, people? What's going on here?
I know, seriously. Sometimes I question whether I know what I'm doing here.
No, I'll just have to, you know, I'm heartbroken. I'll have to change the site to Untitled Goose Center instead of NBA Live Series Center, but... it always helps to have backup plans. But no, that is awesome. When you're editing the names, I missed it. Can you also change some of the faces as well, or is it kind of locked in that respect?
That's a great question, and currently we're working on that, but we're not to that point yet.
That does sound very difficult too, because I know you've done a lot of work putting those faces together and the avatars that pop up at the top of the screen. So I imagine that would be a lot of work.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, so now that we've got your extensive knowledge here, are there any face editors in games that you like? What are your favorite games, past games or current games, that have some kind of face editor that you have the most fun with?
You know, I do have to give the current 2K games, Derek, a fair amount of credit for what they've done with the face sculpting. It's when you do create a face for your My Player these days, it's a lot less like back in the day. It's like, well, that's a created player in the middle of real players, but now it actually does look very, you know, the created players really stood out. So I do have to give them credit. 2005, Live 2005 had a pretty good one as well. And I'm trying to think of one for all its other issues. Fox Sports NBA Basketball 2000 actually has pretty good face sculpting and created player features, so there's been a few over the years.
This is tough, and the biggest reason is because I know your game. So you know what you're basing your game off of is back in the day when players didn't even have faces while they're playing, right? So you know, you look at Double Dribble, they're just all bald and there's no eyes. And then you go back to, and then you go a little bit forward to Tecmo Super NBA Basketball, and they all, you know, they don't have eyes and they don't have a nose and they don't have a mouth. But when you're talking about, you know, the face that pops up in the top left, top right hand corners, I love those, by the way. I think it adds a whole new dimension to the game. That's something that hasn't been done that often in past games. So it's hard to, my favorite creative player feature is actually not in a basketball game. It's in a game called AO International Tennis, where you can create a player and you can make players look basically exactly like they do in real life. But I don't think that's what you want for your game, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want something that sophisticated because it's a different type of engine system
that's
and goal.
That's very true. Yeah.
So I like what Andrew said. I like Andrew mentioning NBA Live 95. Being able to basically do the super basics, maybe have like four or five different hairstyles, obviously be able to change the skin color, and being able to have maybe 8 to 10 preset faces, and then just be able to add basic facial hair. So my opinion is you're not going to go the route of being able to, I want my nose to be this long, I want my nose to be this wide, or my ears to be this big. What you're going to want is like 8 to 10 preset faces and just a few different preset hairstyles, and then the ability to add facial hair, and then boom, you're done.
I agree.
Yeah, that's basically where we've settled on it.
That sounds good. And then I know it's not wise to basically broadcast your regrets, but I honestly think just by how strong the response was to the game of, we need to be able to customize this, like, right off the bat. People wanted to customize it, and that is not something we foresaw when we started making the game. And it's such a big deal that I honestly wish I could go back in time and realize that we need to make this customizable from the get-go. You know what I mean? And our decisions would have been different.
Yeah, we had no idea that there was such a large basketball modding community.
Yeah, it's like they see it as a part of the experience. It's like a major part of the experience for them.
Yeah, we hadn't yet found NLSC. We didn't even know that such a thing existed.
Right. Yeah, so anyway, I think if we could go back, I would have started with this kind of a system, you know, player creator system, face profile creation system, and then from there maybe made our rosters using those systems, but basically started from the mindset of customizability.
It's fine, you know, and also broadcasting your regrets is kind of what we do here on the NLSC podcast. But I mean, it's one of those things that, I mean, even up until NBA Live 18, EA had left roster editing out of the game on this generation, only to patch it in, and it still has issues on Live 18 and 19. So, I mean, even a AAA studio is leaving out things like that. I think it was important for Basketball Classics as the concept to launch. You know, if it alleviates your regrets at all, you know, I think it was important for it to launch as it is and to find that audience, and then it kind of makes people realize, oh, you know, we can customize, because I suppose a lot of people aren't used to that level of customization, and some people do just want to pick up and play, but certainly, yes, in our community, we have that very strong modding community, which I think people will really take to having that, and I absolutely agree with what Derek is saying as far as having the 8 to 10 presets or so, and in fact, to that end, I think NBA Live 97 had a pretty good system with its graphics that I might send you through some videos of that in action and show you the face, the parts swapping in Live 97. If you may remember that, or I can send along some assets, and I think that might be something to base it on.
Yeah, that would be. We love that.
But that's definitely the way to go.
Yeah, I point out the NLSC is a safe space until you bring up Bart Space Mutants, and then just all bets are.
The hatred of the game is
you brought it up 5 times on one of the previous podcasts.
I did, and you've beaten me to it on this one, so I've got to bring up Sid Meier's Pirates for NES. I know you guys like that one.
NES? No, Pirates. I saw your post on Instagram, so that I was so jealous when I saw that. I've wanted Pirates for a long time, but have you been able to play it?
Yeah, I tested it out to make sure that it was indeed working. Had to get that one from the UK. It's difficult to track down a PAL version of that, a PAL A version, which is UK and Australia. There's a listing on eBay for it for $200, and I thought, well, that's more than I want to pay for it for a start. But then I had a closer look, and it was a listing for just the box and manual for $200. Like, now I'm not paying that for just... No, I want the game. But that's complete in box prices, sir. But, no, I picked that up. That was the one I played all those years ago. I do have Pirates Gold on PC and the 2004 remake as well, and the 87 version, because it's on Good Old Games, GOG.com. But I did want that NES version as well, so I was quite happy to get that.
So are you a big... Because I'm actually a really, really pretty big NES collector. I didn't... What's your collection like?
Well, of course, there is Bart versus the Space Mutants. also, Bart versus the World, which is on the same engine and has all the same problems, pretty much. No, it's actually not that extensive. I've kind of on Nintendo on those consoles, I've kind of got it whittled down to my absolute favorites. Probably about I want to say maybe 20-25 NES games. Super Nintendo is maybe a bit more, probably around about the 40-50. And bigger. I mean, also a lot of doubles of basketball games as well. I mean, they pad out the collection, of course, on top of your Super Mario World and Donkey Kong Country 1, 2, and 3 and things like that. So yeah. I do collect beyond, wrestling games as well. I do collect beyond basketball games, and basketball games are certainly the bulk of the collection. And the oddities that I've found, Jam It, Nicktoons basketball. Wow, I can't wait to talk about that in Wayback Wednesday, because that's really something. SpongeBob balling out.
I have not played Nicktoons basketball.
We talked about this on a previous podcast about the cartoon basketball games, like Looney Tunes basketball and Tiny Toons basketball stuff. Those games still have a place. I'm telling you, those games are still fun. And they can actually be pretty competitive. One of my favorite games was Tiny Toons basketball. It was part of Tiny Toons Acme All-Stars game and stuff. And you had like 10 different Tiny Toons you could choose from. And it was 3-on-3 full court. And, you know, you had anvils dropping on you. And it's just like, this is awesome. This is a cool way to play basketball. But they still have their place. I haven't tried the Nicktoons basketball one, but I'm sure there's still some fun that people can be can have with those games.
These days, it's 5,000 VC to have an anvil drop on your head. It's really something. But before we get into our main discussion, since you brought it up, what's your collection like as far as NES and other consoles?
I have I've been using one of the database apps for my NES collection, and I think I've got something like, there's the ultimate, let me read it again, ultimate NES guidebook, the app. So I use that actually to look at my collection.
Oh, from Pat the NES Punk, Pat Contry.
Yes, actually. And I think... let me pull it up. You're just forced to do this. Okay, I've almost got 150 games.
Nice.
And I'm kind of like what you do, where I used to be like, I want to complete the whole set. There's like 700 or whatever.
And there's so many bad ones.
Holy crap, there's so many bad ones. And so many like really expensive bad ones. I think that'll be later in my life when I'm spending... You know, hopefully they get more into the bargain bin like Atari games are right now. But, yeah, you can go and buy a really terrible game for hundreds of dollars. But right now I'm focusing on the ones I really want that are great, actual playable games. And Pirates is one of them that I don't have. But
now, do you go complete in box, or do you just, because you do want to play the games?
I've got some pretty cool complete in boxes. I just got Worm, and then I got Band, Worm is nuts, if you've ever seen that one. And they're in really good condition, too.
Mm.
But
see, I'll go complete in box if I can. I mean, if it happens to be and the price is okay. But then something, because I recently got a PS3, so I've been able to actually import some of the college games from the past generation. And if you want to go complete in box for College Hoops 2K8, you can be spending up to $300 or $400 Australian dollars, to say nothing of then another $50 postage from the US. So I've got a couple of just disc-only versions, which I got for around about $50 or so, and I'm quite happy with that. Would it be nice to have the box and the manual and everything and complete? Sure, but I wanted the games to play and to cover for the site.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm with you.
As far as NES having that, so many poor games, the problem is they, so many companies saw the success of Mario, and then they were like, oh, we're going to make a platformer. It's going to suck, but it will sell. And so everybody started making platformers. And
I know
most of them have the attention to detail. And
some of them Simpsons themed.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I was thinking, because they did, I was thinking about it just the other day. They did like the Black Box series, where there's the Black Box games.
Yep.
And one of Josh's favorite games on there is Pro Wrestling, right?
Yeah.
Like Pro Wrestling was this sweet game. You could talk to Pro Wrestling.
I love Pro Wrestling.
But it's like they made all these different really varied games, Excitebike, Pro Wrestling, these things that are totally, you do not see clones of those games. You see clones of Mario, and it's like so many developers just looked at the success of just Mario and repeated that, and so then it's too much of the NES is just, we're just going to platform every intellectual property we can think of.
Yeah, and we're going to switch the A and B button around so that some, you know, everyone and most of the good games, A is jump and B is attack or whatever secondary action you have. But no, we're just going to make the B button jump in this one, so you have to relearn everything.
So for me, yeah, like when I was growing up, though, I tried to mix it up. You were talking about collections and stuff. So like for me, I had Marble Madness, which I think is still awesome. Yeah, you had, you know, ice hockey and Jordan versus Bird and Double Dribble and stuff for sports. And then you had Contra, which I still think is the greatest Nintendo game of all time. You know, you're able to like mix it up and find these different titles. But you're right. Out of the 700, 800, 900 titles, I would say that probably 400 or 500 of them are really bad. Also, Dr. Mario is a good game too. That was another type of genre that you could kind of get into. Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of poor quality games, unfortunately.
Yeah, you know what? I should do that. I should go through and see, like, genre wise, how many games are platform clones? How many games are like crappy puzzle clones? And how many games are crappy shooters? And it's like probably the bulk of the system.
For sure.
Fit in there.
For sure.
So are you going after the Nintendo World Championship cartridge as well?
How badly do I wish I could? Yeah, like The Wizard is one of my favorite movies of all time. I wish I could go back in time and go to the actual Nintendo World Championships.
You know, I've never seen the movie. I've only seen like reviews of the movie.
Of The Wizard?
Of The Wizard, yeah.
It's dang good. It's really dang good. But yeah, no. The cart you're talking about, trying to get like a gold NWC cart.
Yeah, because I mean they've got the reproduction carts and so forth. But if you can get like the original with amazing collector's items.
I hate reproduction carts with all my heart and soul. Like I just wish they didn't exist, because yeah, it completely the idea of collecting then just falls apart as soon as somebody recreates that item. You're like, oh, crap, well, why would I ever go and buy, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. There is something a bit phony about it, especially if it's marketed as an original, which I'm sure the retro collection market is probably filled with them. And you brought up a great point that it's become very expensive to collect a lot of these games, kind of in the mid to late 2000s, I think, before it really took off collecting. And I know Pat has talked about this on, you know, the CU podcast and everything, and he and Ian, they've talked about how it was very cheap, like Atari cartridges, as you said, for a while there, and then it really took off and people saw, you know, like him collecting and other people collecting and James Rolfe and whatnot, and so, oh, you know, we've got to get this collection too. Then all of a sudden it became, the demand came there, so you could just put the prices up. So maybe if the bubble bursts on it, maybe it will come down again. And but it's important that we do preserve those cartridges, because it's one of those things where I think people thought, oh, you know, these are old games, we're never going to play them again. It's like throwing out VHSs or records, and then, oh, no, we actually kind of wish we still had them.
I totally agree. I was collecting those in 2000, not to brag, but in 2004 I was collecting like at kind of one of the low points there, and I remember being like, if I had to spend $3 for one of these games, that's my limit, you know. if it's more than $3, forget about it, you know. I go back now and I wish I had picked up some of those more expensive titles back then.
I actually have a question for all three of you. I don't know if you remember, this is just a random thought, but as we do on the NLSC podcast, just bring up random things. Did you ever play the track and field game that had the pad that you actually had to run on?
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
What a cool idea.
Yeah.
I love that game, and I wish I still had it, and I haven't looked up to see if I can get my hands on it, but just the fact that you could physically run, and it was two players too, the pad was big enough for somebody else, you could run next to somebody and really like race like that back then in like the late 80s, early 90s, that was just such a cool concept.
They should have done a Dance Dance Revolution back then, like don't you think they could have still done a Dance Dance Revolution game on with that power pad?
I imagine so, yeah.
It's the same idea. It's the same idea, absolutely. They could have.
Yeah. Like a rhythm game on the power pad would have been sweet.
Yeah.
I don't know if they probably have one I don't know about. I don't know.
What would they be? What would the music be, though? Madonna? Like, what would you be? What would it be back then?
I could still be Japanese B-side stuff, whatever, since Revolution.
So, Men Without Hats, you can dance if you want to. Just something like that. Wait, I mean, are you going to license Michael Jackson? Well, maybe Sega is going to license Michael Jackson since they did for Moonwalker. But it's funny that a lot of these concepts, and maybe this will tie into some of the things we'll be talking about as we get into our main discussion, a lot of things are older than people think, whether it's basketball games, mechanics like a shot meter, or again, motion controls and light guns from back in the day that evolved into things like the controllers for the Wii and other motion controls and things like that, and NBA Baller Beats on the Xbox 360. It's interesting that a lot of this stuff is older than people think.
Yeah, well, for sure. Absolutely.
So with that being said, we will dive into our main discussion topic this week. We did allude to it on a previous show when we talked about getting you guys back on. Your ears might have been burning even before you listened to that episode, perhaps, when we mentioned that. But Derek and I were talking about what we'd like to talk about with you when we get you on the show. And we've talked a lot about games that we've really enjoyed, games that we've been disappointed by. Last week's episode was kind of a negative one, Derek, about NBA 2K21. It's safe to say we're not really feeling that one.
Yeah, and just a lot of frustration about the gameplay aspects and the rushed rosters and everything. I think one of the things is that, and we've talked about this so many times on the podcast, when you play a video game, the goal is to have more fun than frustration. Like, you should be making memories, more positive memories with the game. And I feel like just over the last especially probably the last 3 or 4 years of releases with a lot of different games, but, you know, with NBA 2K specifically, you haven't had that fun factor, and people are just getting more and more frustrated with the game. And that just defeats the purpose of playing a game, because the whole point is to have fun, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And to that point, we wanted to then turn that into more of a constructive discussion about what makes games, and we've touched on this before, obviously, here and there, and what the games we like and dislike and things, what would make our perfect game and whatever. But we wanted to approach it from a different perspective this week, and kind of the idea of the hallmarks, the traits, the tendencies of good games versus bad games, the things that when you play a disappointing basketball game, that's, whether it's disappointing for you personally or kind of the consensus of it, what are the general traits of those games that make them disappointing, that the common factors of that, and also what makes them a good game, what are the traits that are common to the better releases and the classics that we love. And one of the reasons we wanted to get you guys, Josh and Dave, on the show is because obviously you are developers, you have made a basketball game, and so not only are you gamers, as Derek and I are, so you have that perspective as people who have enjoyed basketball games, but then you've taken that knowledge and those preferences and made a basketball game. So we thought we'd get your perspective on that as both gamers and developers, designers, etc., and how what you've noticed of those games growing up, the good and the bad, and how you've applied that to basketball classics.
Yeah, great. I mean, when we were researching for basketball classics, I know I had a long document. You know, we went back and we just played like as many of the old basketball games as we could. And we just had a list of the things, you know, what did this one do right? What did it do wrong? What did this one do right? What did it do wrong? And that was kind of a jumping off point for how to approach basketball classics, and I tried so hard to find that document and couldn't. That would have been awesome to be able to pull that up, but yeah, I've gone and written down some notes here. I mean, I was definitely able to recall a lot of the things that drove basketball classics, and then the things that that stuck out to us in our research, looking back more at historical games. I mean, that's definitely going to be at least where I'm coming from more, is a little bit more the retro angle, more than the modern 2K. But, yeah.
Oh, go for it, yeah.
Yeah, I've got a few things to say about modern 2K as well.
Sure, lay it on us.
Go ahead. Absolutely.
Burn your bridges. Make enemies. We already have.
it doesn't matter at this point. Go for it. Yeah.
Okay, let's start off with a couple of strengths. What are some good strengths of modern 2K? I mean, the graphics are incredible. I mean, it's a technical marvel, right? At least in screenshots, but. Once I start to see these modern games in motion, I can't do it. The animations, like, they're just so obviously like stitched together. Like, okay, now we're in this animation, and then it pops into this other animation, and it pops into this other animation, and it's not fluid, and it drives me nuts. One of the other things, you know, there is like with the skating. I hate the skating around the court.
Did I ever tell you that I love you guys? Sorry,
I was going to say. You just made a friend for life, Derek.
You just made a friend for life, and I'm forever in your debt. So continue, please.
Oh, it's the worst. I mean, you take it from there.
Sorry for interrupting there. When you said that, the fact that foot planning isn't a priority in a sports game where foot planning is so important, being able to change directions, being able to move from one foot to the other. You can see it from the broadcast camera or the 2K camera. And then when and you can feel it, and it impacts control and results. And then when you actually zoom in and you actually look at it close up, you're like, these guys are literally sliding on every step.
Yeah.
I'll let you continue, but yeah, just, you made a friend for life, so thank you. Appreciate you bringing up skating. I've been talking about it since 2K18. Andrew knows. It just drives me absolutely off the wall. So.
Yeah, it ruins it for me. It ruins the whole experience, just that one thing alone. And, I mean, they've said for years that they've made it a priority, like, okay, guys, we finally fixed the skating. If from now on feet will properly plant, and then day one, like, everyone comes out, nope, and they're still skating. Like, why can't they fix this?
And I think, and not to interrupt, but, well, although I am, it's kind of what I do on the podcast, actually, hog the mic. It's something that Derek and I have talked about a lot, not just the look of it, not just the aesthetic, but the fact that players can slide into place and essentially travel or get to where they need to go without really moving, and because the defensive AI doesn't think they're moving because the feet aren't moving, but they're sliding away, the defender doesn't really follow them. So there's all kinds of, it's not just the aesthetic. People say, oh, well, it's not going to be perfect. And no, it's easier said than done to make great realistic physics in a sports game, a AAA or otherwise, but there's so much about it that it's not just, oh, we're nitpicking the aesthetic. It's the actual experience on the sticks.
Yeah, and the other part too that, you know, you brought up, and I think we brought it up on other shows, and I've been bringing it up on the forum for years, is they did do it right in the past, right? And that's where it's so frustrating, is we talked about games like 2K15, 2K16, and 2K17, and I've shown this in, you know, video examples and made videos about it. The foot planning was far better. And it felt far better. And Andrew's talked about his enjoyment playing 2K17 as well. But, and then all of a sudden, like you guys said, every single year since 2K18, they release a title. And in the developer blog, they say, hey, we address the skating. We address the foot planning. And then you play the game and it's worse than the year before. So it's like, it just doesn't make sense to me, and it does impact outcomes. And if you go back and play a game like 2K11, which Andrew plays, and he's modding it right now, the foot planning is far better, and in turn, the feel feels better, and you have more control. So
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, there's got to be more to the story there that we don't like. We don't understand. Yeah.
Now, how does live compare to 2K?
With footwear,
as far as the skating and the planting. Skating.
You know, I feel that it kind of looks better, and that there is more of that realistic heft to the players and the feel, but at the same time, live can also feel a bit clunky at times, especially online. Both games are trying to address it and address the feel and the foot planting, the aesthetics and the feel. I don't think either of them have quite got it right yet. I don't know how Derek feels, so I'll throw it over to him. But yeah, that's how basically my take is that they're both approaching it from different angles, and you can see what they're trying to do, but they neither of them have quite got it right yet, for my money.
So Live 19 is the last one that EA released. They didn't do Live 20 or Live 21. But for Live 19, as far as like movement, as far as the way it looks, from the gameplay standpoint and whatnot, it is smoother. There's less skating. The changing of direction makes more sense, etc. But like as Andrew alluded to, not only is it clunky, and they made it even more clunky with patches, which this is a whole nother story about overpatching games and ruining them through patches. But the game was absolutely cluttered with two-man animations. And you, Josh and Dave, you both just brought that up. One of the biggest problems in sports games now is making everything canned. You drive to the hoop and the game decides what you do, not you.
Right? Yeah.
You're dragged to a defender on your side or your back or in front of you. You're stuck doing an animation that you didn't choose to do. You're pushed, you're dragged into the hoop. You try to shoot like a mid-range jump shot. I know mid-range is extinct, but in reality, it still happens sometimes. Right. But you try to pull up from mid-range and you get dragged into the hoop. And stuff like that. And that overall just gives a negative experience because of lack of control. So I think where Live does have smoother animations, especially recently with Live 19, there's still that clunky, canned feel where you don't feel like you have enough control.
Yeah, sometimes it almost feels like Dragon's Lair to me. Where
Dragon's
it's like it's checking your input once every 1.5 seconds. And it decides, okay, then we're going to play this animation. And then once that completes, it's like, okay, what is the player input telling us right now? Okay, then let's play that animation. And it just doesn't feel responsive enough to me, at least coming from this as more of a retro gamer, where, some of those older games are still have like the best controls ever. Where you just definitely feel in control. And I mean, I'm not even talking just basketball games here, just any retro games, any of the platformers or whatever, or even the modern ones, Spelunky or whatever, where control is king, and it just doesn't feel that way in modern basketball.
You mentioned Dragon's Lair. Obviously, my career in 2K does have the story, does have quick time events, but it doesn't have dragons. So that is something that perhaps 2K could look at. Dragons worked out very well for Game of Thrones, at least until Season 8 anyway. I know exactly what you mean. And I think to that point, one of the hallmarks, the traits of bad games or flawed games, is that they don't have that right feel of player movement and that feel on the sticks. There's something off about player movement and the responsiveness, that what you're doing with the controller is just not lining up really well with what you're seeing on the screen, and it's just not a great experience from that feel aspect.
And I think Josh and Dave can agree with this, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this as well, about where you're talking about the overall experience. I absolutely hate artificial boosts in basketball video games or sports video games. I hate, because it takes away the skill. Right. Games that are so heavily dependent on badges or cards that ramp up your player artificially and everything. And it makes it so somebody who is not as skilled can beat you 10 times out of 10 times because they have these artificial boosts. I don't think that artificial boosts belong in sports games. And I kind of wanted to get your takes on that.
If it doesn't feel fair. If it doesn't feel fair, it's over for me. Yeah, all of a sudden. And that's why I think rubber banding was dangerous. If it doesn't feel fair, then it turns me off completely. And then it's not competitive. And then what is it? You know, is it a halfway controllable movie? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I agree with that. But
thinking about. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
No, in terms of, like, the sensation that Andrew's talking about, too, Josh has a big list of these sensations that, like, we focused on at the beginning, don't you? On here?
Well, yeah, I mean, I do. Let's see. Do we want to get into this quite yet? Yeah, I mean, we definitely, like, so in basketball classics, you know, when we're going back and looking, like, Double Dribble to me actually feels pretty good. It's not as fun to play these days as it was when I was a kid, but they did some things beautifully, and I thought that the shot feel was one of the things that they really nailed on that. I mean, they were one of the first, you know, to do, like the hold, mm-hmm. you know, and release to shoot, right? Press to jump, release to shoot. And, you know, that felt pretty good. But then just the making a shot felt so good in that. And that was one thing that Dave and I really studied, like, okay, what happens with the net here?
Yeah.
You know, when that ball goes through the net, you know, it makes that sound, and the way the net, like, flips up.
Yeah.
It was, like, so satisfying. And so that was one thing that we really prioritized. Like, I think within the first week of creating basketball classics, we had him making that net like flip up when it goes through, and like trying to make that as satisfying as possible. Yeah, there are things like that we really prioritized.
Yeah, that was like a it's feedback. Mm-hmm. I think it's feedback to the player.
I think that's a fantastic point. And it's funny you mentioned the net, because it's one of those things that a lot of basketball gamers over the years have said, oh, the net looks terrible in this game, or it's too long, it's too thin, it doesn't swish right. And it really does come down to, obviously in the sim games, it's all about making it look as realistic as possible. But even in a stylized game like a basketball classics with that throwback to the 8-bit, 16-bit era, it is just like you say, that feedback that gives the gamer that excitement, that feeling of accomplishment, or, you know, that looked cool. You know, it's like an NBA Live 95 when you get the dunks and your player runs back and he's pointing at the opponent. You know, it's not very sophisticated, but it's just like, yeah, you know, it pumps you up. It's like that is something that, like you say, feedback, not just beyond just getting the 2 points and doing something to win the game. It's also having those moments within the game that capture the moments of the real sport as well. But like with any game, just having that bit that feels good and satisfying, the sound of Scorpion's spear in his kunai in Mortal Kombat, collecting a coin in Mario Brothers. You know, just something that's very satisfying about the aesthetically and from an audio perspective. Absolutely, I get it. I think that's a great point.
Well, it's a well-deserved reward, right, for the player. And it's something that they earned by shooting that shot. It's almost the same thing as in real life. If you take a shot from the outside, you know, in real life, and it goes nothing but net, how do you feel? You feel pretty good, you know, when you see the net go up and whatnot. So, no, I think that's great that you focused on that. Another good aspect of Double Dribble, too, is the ball dribbling sound effect. I really like that part of it. I think some of the sound effects in some of the past games were awesome. Not the ball going through the air. I don't think that needed to be there, really. No. But it was still kind of cool. But,
yeah. right. Let's see here. I noted that which ones was it that had... Oh, the Bulls versus Lakers and the Bulls versus Blazers games. That terrible ball bouncing. That was, like, the worst sound. I hated that one so much. I'm not just the thung, 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 thung the entire game.
not only that with those games, I wanted to put out, you guys did a great job with pace. One of my problems with Bulls versus Blazers is the sluggishness, and I'm sure you wrote that down as something you didn't want. Just how players look like they were moving kind of in like slow motion. You have more of a Tecmo Super NBA basketball type pace, which is more fast and like more like real basketball. So yeah, I definitely appreciated the pace of basketball classics.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that, I mean, that was definitely one of the things that we noticed in a lot of the older games. They were just too slow. I mean, there were some that even have like a cool look, and they seem like they would be fun to play, but then they just move way too slow. Like street sports basketball was one. I mean, you just want them to move like 4 or 5 times as fast as they do. It's crazy. But yeah, I mean, of course, then like, you know, you end up with NBA Jam, which is like, I don't know, is NBA Jam too fast?
NBA Jam is pretty fast. It's pretty fast. Yeah.
You know, you touched on a couple of other things there as well about the, you know, obviously the feedback of the shot, but also the mechanics that it not just look good and the result made you feel good, but also the feel, and it goes not just player movement as we talked about before, but general mechanics, because there's been a lot of games, and I brought it up before. I've done a Way Back Wednesday on it. NBA All-Star Challenge for the Super Nintendo. I know that, Derek, you've played that one before as well, where shooting required you to press the shot button and then press it a second time for the release, rather than your traditional hold and release. I recently picked up, and fortunately very cheaply, Kid Sports Basketball, which is this horrible shovelware game by Data Design Interactive. That they just crapped out a bunch of these terrible sports games for kids. It is the most difficult thing ever with its mechanics. I would give a kid NBA Jam. I would give a kid NBA 2K with all sophistication before I give them this piece of crap. Kid Sports Basketball. It's very much a shovelware game, but there is a jump button and a shoot button. So if you want to take a jump shot, you have to press jump and then shoot at the right time. So you have to press two different buttons to get it. And it's just such a bad... Again, it's aimed at a young audience, and I think it's too clunky for me. And I'm never going to claim to be the best basketball game ever, but I like to think I'm pretty proficient. But it's just... It is garbage. I can't wait to put the Way Back Wednesday out there, but it's because I've already drafted it. But it just gets so many things wrong. And it's clearly just, again, just shovelware out there, but, and it's meant for a young audience, but it's so complex and contrived that, a game like NBA Jam, if you want to teach young gamers about basketball and get them introduced in the sport and actually have some fun with it on the virtual hardwood, a game like NBA Jam or NBA Playgrounds even these days. Whereas this game was one of the things I think is very important, and of course you guys got it right with Basketball Classics, is having familiar mechanics. There's a certain way of doing basketball games and their mechanics that you can change things up and have things here and there that a new wrinkle, a new like super move or something like that. There's room to experiment, but I think there's some basic things that basketball games, how they need to work as far as jump shots and driving and dunking and things like that. And a hallmark of all the bad games I've played, they miss out. They don't do the basics of controls properly. And that is pretty much standard of any game that I would call terrible, a terrible basketball game. And of course, any game in general. And it goes back to play, to movement and things like that. But the basic mechanics of the game, if they've tried to do something stupid, contrived, so different to every other basketball game out there, that's the hallmark of a bad game. It's the basics of virtual basketball, and they've messed it up, basically. That is a hallmark of a bad game.
Well, without a doubt. I mean, without a doubt. And you have to... we're going to be talking about NBA Jam quite a bit, obviously, but... Yeah, NBA Jam comes from a point of view of, like, you know video games, but... you might not know basketball, like the specifics of basketball. So we're going to make a video game of basketball. And everything before that was like, this is basketball. Now try to learn it. You know, but this is like, no, you know how to play video games. You run like this, you jump like this, and you hit like this, you know? And then they're like, let's do basketball like that.
Hmm.
And you're one player. So I think that's one reason why NBA Jam hit so hard is because they weren't trying to reinvent the wheel in terms of controls, right?
Yeah.
It's sometimes the simple controls are the best controls. Because really the most important thing for a gamer are, you know, the aspect of control, being able to control your destiny. And this goes for sports and non-sports, and having low input lag where it's reactive. In my opinion, those are the two most important things in a sports game, control and low input lag. And I just want to say something real quick about NBA All-Star Challenge because I grew up with it. The moment you shoot like 8 air balls in a row with Larry Bird, you know that the game's not good. And the shooting mechanics,
yeah.
The shooting mechanics in that game were so frustrating. I liked the game, and it has a nostalgia feel to it. But yeah, the moment you pop like 8 air balls in a row with Larry Bird, it's just time to put it down.
I mean, that is the thing, is that nostalgia, we have nostalgia for games, and you know, the obvious example was brought up, the game that shall not be named by me, again, because I mentioned it so much, Barbarous the Space Mutants. I mean, it's the joke is, obviously, it is a very flawed game. And I've got into it before with the jump and run. You've got to push the two buttons to actually to run. You've got to press the jump button to run, things like that. It's not well designed, but there is a nostalgia because you kind of get used to it. And it's the same way when you play with All-Star Challenge, is that you can play it, and you can get used to the clunkiness and how it feels and how ridiculous it is to snap into position in the horse game, and how you can shoot threes with Patrick Ewing as well as Larry Bird, and it shows player stats, but they may as well not be in the game for how much the abilities seem to matter and how there's no differentiation. But you do have that nostalgia for games that are flawed like that, because there's something about them. There's something about the aesthetic. It's an NBA game. It's one of the few games in the 90s that has Michael Jordan in it. So it's one of those things that you can feel nostalgia, but at the same time you can also admit, yeah, parts of that kind of really sucked. But It is that accessibility that you mentioned with NBA Jam, that you can just pick up and play. It's accessible to people who love basketball and people who are not familiar with basketball. And I'm guessing that that's something that you looked at with Basketball Classics as well, that pick up and play aspect. And that is a definitely a trait of good and great games, that there's no confusion, there's no overwhelming sense of what the hell am I doing. Kind of thing, especially if you are a seasoned basketball gamer, there is that pick up and play accessibility to it.
For sure, and so yeah, I mean, even just the running, the jumping, the shooting, like those things, they have to feel familiar and they have to feel good. But then once you start to get into like the rules of basketball, that's where it gets tricky, and we had to create the tutorial, like the warm-up area at the beginning of each match, just to kind of help ease people into those basic mechanics, you know, just of, I mean, well, so like, for instance, I mean, there's a whole play calling aspect, which is a hard thing, you know, for someone who is coming at the game from the perspective of a video gamer, not someone who knows basketball. Like, how do you teach them to use the plays in the game?
Mm-hmm. What is a pick and roll?
We almost had to rebalance the game like a little bit to make it so that you could play it without calling them.
Yes.
So that you could play and you could win, at least at the lower difficulty levels, without using the plays. And that was one thing that was kind of hard for me to concede, like, because the plays are one thing that we focused on from day one, that we felt like it's kind of set our game apart, because we tried to make a simplistic but effective play calling system. And so to finally have to like throw our hands up a bit and say, well, okay, on rookie, like, you don't have to use it. that was a little hard for me, but it was something that we had to do, to kind of bow down to that idea of pick up and playability.
Yeah.
Along those lines, Derek and I have talked about it before, and a couple of the examples we've brought up include the difficult puzzles in Lemmings, which of course is a classic game, and also the infamous Turbo Tunnel in Battletoads. Is that the developers, because they tested the game so much, and because of course they made it, they were so familiar with it that they just kept ramping up the difficulty because we know how to beat it, but then it suddenly gets into the hands of gamers who are going in fresh and blind, and I think a couple of the developers of Battletoads have said, yeah, we didn't mean to make it that hard. It's just we found it really easy in all the testing phases, so then we put it out there and we've just put this mega hard game, how 90s mean mega hard, of this really ridiculously hard level in the game because we knew how to beat it because we made it, we tested it. Did you have the same thing with Basketball Classics? Because I know a couple of the patches have tweaked the difficulty a little bit.
Yeah, I would say the bulk of patches we've done have been related to difficulty tweaks, don't you think?
The bulk. I would 100% agree. The bulk of patches we've done are difficulty tweaks.
Yeah, and it's for that reason. I mean, once we released, we had been playing it for 2 years at the time we released it on Early Access. You know, we've been playing it for 4.5 years now, and it's hard to judge. Like, okay, I mean, clearly, like, we're probably the two most skilled Basketball Classics players in the world.
I'd hope so.
And how do we decide, like, does this feel right to a beginner?
Exactly.
I mean, we can't. We're incapable of making that decision. And so, yeah, I mean, early on, like in Early Access, we had a lot of people return the game, you know, request refund through Steam because it was too hard. And it was like, oh, shoot.
Noobs.
Let's scale it.
One of the problems with that, though, is who do you listen to, right? I think that's the other thing. So if you have two people, and we've talked about this with patching, with Andrew and I have talked about this at length, where games are definitely overpatched now, I think probably one of the hardest things, and I think you would agree, is what feedback do you listen to? If two people return it and complain about the difficulty, but you see that, let's say, 400 people bought the game, and out of those 400 people, it was only those two people that complained, you have to look at the way the feedback is presented and if, you know, hey, I should patch this based on those two people. So I would say that I'm guessing that that's probably one of the biggest challenges is to say, hey, this person complained about it, but does it really need to be changed? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, we had a lot of back and forth, you know, taking it too far one way, too far the other. It's been hard to find the right balance, and so we finally just settled on, okay, let's just add more difficulty settings.
I mean, the main mistake was listening to somebody who runs a basketball gaming website who is there presenting himself as an authority on basketball games and yet used a code to unlock himself in Basketball Classics. That's that was your first mistake, you know. Sorry about that. But no, it's obviously the issue, and as Derek said, who do you listen to? Me, the cheesy cheater, apparently. But it's one of those things with basketball games that, unlike other genres, representing basketball, the idea, because you're going to have infractions, you're going to have missed shots and things, the idea of most games, and a lot of bad games fall into this trap, is that if you don't have that perfect play, you won't, you won't succeed. But this can be a situation where, to use the TV Tropes mantra, you know, and direct everyone to TV Tropes and let them ruin their day by spending hours on that wiki, that tropes are not good, tropes are not bad, tropes are tools. So difficulty doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. For example, you look at something like The Phantom Five. Now, if the whole game of Basketball Classics was like that, it probably would be pretty frustrating. But that is a special part of the story mode. It's a special challenge. It's much like the boss battles in NBA Live 2010, that it's kind of an exaggerated challenge. It's there for your... hardcore gamers that are playing through the story mode and want that challenge. Again, if every single game was like that in the regular season mode or exhibition mode, it would be very frustrating. It probably wouldn't be the way to go. But as a special, you know, this is a challenge mode. It is challenging you to basically have perfect play or close to. I think it works for that. But bad games fall into the trap of, well, you have to play perfectly because the CPU is going to play perfectly. And a lot of those games, they're great as two-player games, but not great as one-player games. So I think that's another thing that when you look at the good and bad games, is that the best games are good as both single-player and multiplayer because of the way they handle difficulty.
Yeah, I want to point out, too, is there are games in the past that have struck the right balance, and those are oftentimes the best games, the ones that they cater to the casual player. The player can pick up and play. They feel like, you know, what Josh and Dave were talking about, they have the control. They can control their destiny. And then there's the players that can ramp up the difficulty level, get that challenge against the computer, but also feel like there's a skill gap and what you do matters when you're playing against another person. Those games do exist, as opposed to a game like Dark Souls, where you jump in and right when you start playing, you're like, all right, I'm going to die a million times on this first level, no matter how good I am at the game. And a lot of people get frustrated with those types of games.
Cuphead would be another. It's aimed at the elite, you know, people who want that super ridiculous challenge, as opposed to the pick up and play and appeal to everybody on a sliding scale.
But when the computer starts cheating you, that's a problem. Remember, we talked about that on my team with NBA 2K21, Andrew.
Absolutely, know, and it comes
when
back
the
to the
playing different rules, right?
And the rubber banding that you guys mentioned as well, which is kind of one of those mechanics that you need sometimes for difficulty, but can also be extremely frustrating when it feels like it's less of a skill gap and it's like the, you know, and you touched on it before, that it's predetermined, that it's your success is really based on very much an RNG or being allowed to win, basically.
Yeah, without a doubt, I've thought this about 2K, right? So 2K has become this, I have honestly very little bad to say in terms of like the developers of 2K, because I think that they are given a task that is, I'm sure there's a lot of passionate, like, authentic, basketball-loving, video game-loving developers, I'm sure, that work there that would probably hate to think that they have to do these microtransactions and virtual currency and all this stuff that pisses people off. But their task, I think, is flawed, because it's now turned into this thing where the game is supposed to be everything to all people. You know, you have one main basketball choice if you're going to play a video game. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this has to capture the imagination of all basketball fan video gamers. You know, and it just can't. So I think that's where they must deal with just this impossible task. But in a way, you know, they've beat out the competition or whatever, and now they're left with just a whole bunch of people hating their game because it's not exactly what they want it to be. But this one person is going to say it's one thing's wrong with it. The other's going to say something completely different. They might even be completely contradicting each other, you know, the two complaints.
Absolutely. So, no, yeah. There is that big divide, and Derek, you and I have talked about it a lot, a big divide within the basketball gaming demographic, the people who like My League, the franchise modes, or people who like My Career, or the people who like the connected experiences in My Career, but not the NBA side of it. And everybody does have that feedback of this needs to be like this, and who cares about this, and there's a lot of selfishness. And on top of that, then, as you say, they're getting orders from above, from the suits, about putting in microtransactions and everything. They're serving a lot of masters. And it does pull the game in a lot of directions.
Without a doubt. And that's something that I don't think we can understand from a gamer's perspective, like what the challenge that they're faced with. It's kind of impossible.
Yeah, I can. I mean, I can bring up check out my the tweet about the roster issues with NBA 2K. There are certainly things with 2K21, as Andrew's aware of. There are a lot of rush jobs. A lot of lack of detail, a lot of inaccuracies, a lot of throwing a bunch of crap against the wall and hoping it sticks and hoping nobody brings it up and stuff. And that's frustrating as a consumer, especially because, as you stated, there is only one choice, right?
Yeah.
It would be frustrating if there was five or six choices because it's disrespecting the game and its history. And that's a whole other thing in itself. But the problem is that we talked about NBA 2K20 having over 8 million downloads. That's a lot of people. 8 million plus downloads. That's a lot of people. But a lot of people, and we've talked about this, you know, people posting on Operation Sports and on Reddit and whatnot, and you alluded to it, is if you love basketball and you want to play virtual hardwood 5-on-5, you have one choice. So people are going to buy the game and shell out the money, even if they don't really want it or if they even don't like it. And with no competition, it's hard to gauge quality. Am I correct? So the problem is that the game is put on a pedestal, but it's not being competed with against anything quality-wise.
I know. We're in a crazy spot. And there's, like, no clear step forward, and to see NBA Live just be like, we're out. So we can't. You know, it's disheartening.
Yeah.
And did you know that Karl Malone was a three-point gunner? Because in 2K21, the rating suggests that way. I mean, obviously I know that Jazz, there's a lot going on at Jazz games, rubber chickens going up in the air and whatnot. You know, and you know, the Jazz version of Clipper Darryl. But the only time I've seen that Karl Malone, I mean, he did hit a few threes, obviously. The only time I've seen Karl Malone hit threes consistently outside of NBA Jam is the two-ball contest in 1998. He was gunning there and not rebounding, but he was standing out there and shooting from three and making some. But I mean, did they just watch that two-ball contest and said, Karl Malone, the mailman, he delivers from three-point range. That's right. You know, he's airmail from beyond the arc. Yeah.
The problem is all these players and formulas are on a spreadsheet. It's the same reason why I mentioned in that thread, and I encourage both of you to check it out. You know, Glenn Rice has 0.3% tendency, and Dan Issel has a 90. So, I mean, anybody who knows Dan Issel or knows history knows that he wasn't popping threes. He averaged 0.1 attempts per game. But the problem is that people propping up 2K and, you know, all the reviewers and all that stuff, there isn't one review. Hey, Andrew, how many reviews have we looked at? There isn't one review that mentions any of the roster inaccuracies. There's not one review that mentions any of it. There's not one review that mentions the actual skating. There's not a review out there that mentions the lack of control and, you know, the rubber banding, all this stuff. The problem is that people, it feels when you look at these releases that people are being preyed upon. Right? All of this stuff is being concealed. There's only one player in the space. They end up getting these games. They advertise it as complete content, but it's not. And the reviewers don't let people in on this information either, because how many people, like, if they saw that thread, if that information, those roster issues and stuff were talked about with the current and past teams and the players, if those were talked about in reviews, how many people do you think wouldn't buy the game? I think a lot of people would have been like, oh my God, this is terrible. Like, they don't care. So I feel like sometimes, and not to get on a negative rant again, but I just feel like sometimes people are getting taken advantage of, and that's really frustrating to see.
It's kind of the state of AAA gaming, which again makes you sound like such an indie snob to say, indie snob even. There's the rush to get that review out. I think we talked about it last week or the week before, Derek. That rush to get the reviews out, so they don't touch on things like, as you say, rosters and ratings, pack odds in my team, the way the challenges are laid out in my team, and the fairness of the level up system with the new seasons and XP. It'll mention that the review will mention that the seasons are in the game, but not how they work, server quality, how expensive the upgrades are with the VC in my career, and how it relates to the cost of items. Some reviews will touch on it, but a lot of reviews just give a basic rundown of the features, some superficial impressions of the game, but very few reviews go into the nitty-gritty of mechanics like pack odds and things that are very anti-consumer with the loot box mechanics and gambling mechanics and so forth. And it, maybe it's just because we kind of accept it as being part of AAA gaming these days, and the 2K series in particular. But it's one of those things that people just don't mention. And it's a shame, because it is one of the things that, because it is the state of gaming, because they are such negative aspects sometimes, the reviews just don't go into detail. And it's very unfortunate that we don't have... And even some of the content creators, YouTubers and whatnot, kind of skip over that, and it's all about, oh, and here's the OP build, and they've got the mouth open on the thumbnail, and wow, look at this, and all this, everything, but they're not going into those details because they lose access. And that's another problem with gaming, is that you, these days, is that you give feedback, and why I appreciate, you know, you guys being so open to the feedback, is that while it's important to listen to the right people, and there's a lot of negative voices out there that are just yelling, you know, abusively about feedback and whatnot, that... it's kind of shutting out those people that have got valid criticisms and valid feedback to really improve the game, and focusing on the people who will just promote the game. And that's very unfortunate.
Yeah. At last, a couple things I really want to mention quick, too, is that the reviews, they literally say NBA 2K21 is basketball perfection and insanely good simulation experience. Like, that's what the most of them start off with. So I just want to point that out, that obviously those people are not being honest, or they just don't know who. So, yeah.
And, you know, that line reminds me of that season one episode of Friends where Chandler's hitting on Jill Goodacre and says, you know, gum would be perfection. Just this ridiculous line, but anyway. this 2K would be perfection. Why did I say that? But so now that we've burned some bridges in the industry for you, please continue. there will be no Basketball Classics 2K at this point. But, 2K Basketball, 2K Classics, 2K21. It's just going to have 2K across. It's just going to have 2K spread across the whole title.
It is tough, because I'm sure. I guarantee, like Dave's saying, there are passionate gamers and basketball enthusiasts that work at 2K, but I mean, they're owned by, you know, I mean it's a big corporation with shareholders, and you know, I'm sure they get calls down from on high saying it has to have virtual currency, it has to do, you know, these terrible things that exploit the player, but they don't care. I mean, when it comes down to it, they got to make money.
Yeah.
But they have also, unfortunately, kind of painted themselves into a corner with, you know, talking up the simulation and the realism and those things, because then gamers come at it expecting those things, and it's not true. I mean, it is a technological achievement, what they've done, but it's not a perfect simulation, you know. And right now, I mean, it's almost like they're in the uncanny valley, like, area of simulation, not only graphically, but even as far as the gameplay goes.
I actually wrote a Monday Tip-Off article a while back, Basketball Gaming Belongs to Suits, and I don't like to be cynical, which may sound like a weird thing to say after we've been griping on the podcast for the last couple of weeks, but I would prefer not to be. I don't like that I've grown a bit cynical over the years. I'm not a fan of cynicism. I flash back again to the that short-lived Dilbert cartoon where Catbit says cynicism is cynicism is the same as experience. Just think the worst of everybody and you'll probably be right. And that was cynicism about cynicism. It's, you know, cosmic. But I don't like to feel that way. But yes, it does come down to, as you say, pleasing the shareholders, pleasing the suits, making sure they're getting their bonuses. You know, the recurrent revenue is going in their pockets rather than back into the game or the servers. So it's pleasing so many masters that I guess is the advantage that you know that you don't have, as long as you guys are happy. You know, there's you know, I'm guessing as long as you're happy with the game, the majority shareholders of Namo Gamo are quite pleased with how everything's going.
I want to bring something up, though, about feedback and about feeling bad about feedback or being negative. If you can back up your feedback with valid points, and oftentimes, like I've told you and I've shown, you know, video evidence, photo evidence, all of that stuff, they need to hear that feedback. And somebody does need to stick up for these people, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody does need to call out the issue. They need to stick up for these people. They need to call out the microtransaction BS. They need to call out the skating. Not enough people talk about it. They need to talk about the things that people are frustrated with. And oftentimes other people won't speak up about, even though it's negatively impacting them. So I understand the whole thing. Well, oh, I hate being negative, and oh, we're always negative on this podcast, which is not true. But the point is that somebody has to speak up. And if there are issues and you can back it up with facts, you should be speaking up about that. So I never feel bad about giving the correct feedback and critiques, whether, you know, good or bad. I don't feel bad about it.
Fair point. Good point.
I like what you're saying, too, because games are – this form of entertainment is not movies. You know, it doesn't come out and then hope you liked it. You know, it's like a living, breathing thing, especially when you have the same game reiterating itself each year. There, it should be part of the creation, the creative process. You know, gamers should feel like they're part of the creative process at this point. And so to have, like what you're saying, if they can stop just being like, this is trash, burn, whatever, and they can actually be like, you should do this specifically, like you're saying, showing images of the skating, mm-hmm. being like, this is like a clear, constructive, useful kind of feedback that they're getting from actual gamers, really well-experienced gamers that love both basketball and the video game itself. You know what I mean? Like, it's, I agree. I think that it needs to be part of it. So yeah, I don't mean to be like, oh, you can't be negative to them. My point. Well, sorry, you can speak to that.
I agree with you 100%, and I agree that it's got to be really frustrating for those developers who are on the floor because they exist at 2K, who and the mind childs, right? Like, not just the developers, but people, like creative people as well, who are not impacting directly the technology. You know, it's got to be frustrating for those people who are like, this isn't the way it should be, but we can't do anything about it, right? Like, I want to answer to these complaints, and I understand where these people are coming from, but we can't do anything about it. And that's the thing that people need to understand. It's not about, hey, 2K is trash. It's not 2K is garbage. It's not everybody in 2K burn. It's not that or any other company. It is having an understanding that suits do control the overall game, like as far as like the direction of the game, and that not all developers are bad or lazy, that there are people there that will do a good job and care about Hoop, but oftentimes the suits and maybe other people who are also working on the game on the ground floor overshadow them, and that's why we end up with that product. So I want to make a point too that I'm not saying it's all of 2K, and I completely agree with you. I am sure that there are developers for 2K that really care about Hoop and the accuracy and everything.
It's why I don't like the word lazy when we talk about these things. It's one of the, it's become a buzzword. I mean, there are aspects of 2K. Yeah.
Spreadsheet ratings and tendencies are lazy.
Oh, fair. There are definitely things there that, yeah. Yeah. There are, but it's kind of, I think some things, when they say, oh, you haven't included Charles Barkley, lazy. Like, well, no, there's actually a reason that Charles Barkley, that's a licensing issue. That's not like, oh, don't you know about Charles Barkley? We know, we just, the suits don't want to pay him, the suits don't want to pay the retired players fund. You know, they don't want to meet his conditions. You know, that's not a laziness or a lack of knowledge of Charles Barkley. So it's important with feedback to actually come from a place of validity, logic as well. So
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, which was the great thing about Derek's tweet thread, you know. I mean, he clearly explained, like, here are specific issues, you know, with screenshots included. I mean, when you can point out specific copy and paste jobs on player attributes, come on.
Is with that thread guy, I was only showing like 1% of what I was going in and seeing. I mean, there it is, absolutely spreadsheet copy and paste across the board, full sections of players, attributes and tendencies and signatures. I mean, everybody knows that Billy Cunningham didn't have the dunk package of Blake Griffin. But hey, if you want a full copy and paste of Blake Griffin, use Billy Cunningham, because he has the same shooting form, its same dunk package, his same fadeaway, all of that. So I'll say again, some of it is lazy. Some of it is not prioritizing, right? They should be called out on that. And the funny thing is, I'm the only person, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but who else have you seen show that? There isn't anybody that's been talking about this. And this has been going on since 2K16. So again, I want to point out about feedback too, and I don't know if you guys listened to one of the episodes we talked about it. But sometimes it is nice working with the smaller developers, like you, Josh, did. But, you know, PBA Basketball Slam released an early access, and I gave a detailed breakdown, a detailed review on the game and what I thought would need fixing. And in 2 weeks, they put out a patch, and the game just feels much better. So it's really nice to be heard, to be honest.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I think that goes to why people love video games and why, you know, they're in a great position, and they're lucky to have people that are willing to, you know, play the game, and then somebody like you make something constructive, like helpful for them to make it better.
No, thank you. And then, by the way, that's one of the things we preach on the podcast. And I think that people feel a lot of times that companies are too big to, like, they're like, oh, they're not going to listen to me, so they don't say anything. Why not put your best foot forward, right? Like, you know what? Put the feedback out there. If you care about it that much, how many hours do you think that the common NBA 2K gamer spends with the game? Hundreds, right? They're playing these games. They're playing them a lot.
They're playing
If you're going to play that much, get your voice out there. If there's something bothering you, get your voice out there. You know, Mike Wang, he'll sometimes respond. You know, depending on what it is, it's cherry-picked. But, you know, they'll have people that respond sometimes and stuff. But you know what? Put your best foot forward and get the feedback out there.
Yeah. You know, I mean, your tweet got a lot of noise. It got a lot of reaction. So, yeah, I mean, don't worry about your voice not being heard. I mean, somebody heard that. There were a lot of likes and retweets on that. There's definitely a lot of people in agreement with what you're saying.
It's just now it's got to put the plan into action now, I suppose. The ball is in their court. But I will say, as far as observations go, my ratings in basketball classics are very overrated. I am no any that good. Not a complaint, just an observation. Just a fact of life, a sad fact of life for me. But you know, it kind of brings me back to a point. You know, I said that tropes are not good or bad; they are tools, and there are some things in good and bad basketball games, to bring it back to our main topic here, that can be in good games and bad games alike, and they can also be used effectively and ineffectively. You know, I brought up the Phantom 5 as being an example of a good use of perfect play and challenge. When we talk about mechanics of and controls, to back up a little bit, one of my pet peeves in a lot of older games is when pass and switch player are on different buttons, or when there's not that synchronization between offensive and defensive controls in basketball games. But in a game like Basketball Classics, because it is kind of a throwback to old games, I like it there. It can be used very effectively. And I'm sure you looked at some games back in the day that had those controls. In fact, I think we've even talked about it on previous shows with you guys, is that that's something that old games had. And it got to a certain point, certainly when we got to the 3D era, when it got very clunky because you wanted to switch control a lot. And there were deeper controls, so it did get very contrived. But the more simplistic approach of Basketball Classics, I think that's an appealing retro feature. So again, it's one of those examples of how something can be... there's no universal truth. I mean, some things are bad, like the kids sports basketball, having to press one button to jump and another to shoot, that is bad. But there are some, and I would say that's universally bad of any game, but there are other things that can work. They can work based on the concept of the game and the style of the game. So there are some things that can be hallmarks of bad games, but in other games, they're part of the appeal. And that's, I mean, how did you kind of sort that out when you looked at Basketball Classics, if that's anything in your notes there?
Controls wise, we arriving at the at the three button controls, that was actually that was a big kind of debate that we went back and forth with a lot. We really tried to start with two button.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted two button control,
double dribble style. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mhm.
Mhm. And we had a build that was two button. We play tested it with, mm-hmm. with a group of players, and it just didn't, it was too confusing to them. I mean,
yeah,
we were just finally like, okay, we'll have to concede this point. I mean, cause we were trying, you know, of course, I mean, it was kind of an NES inspired title. And I think that was kind of where we wanted to be able to pull it off with two buttons, but, yeah, for and I mean, this was with a group of younger players who are used to playing like 2K style games, but the three button just play tested better is really what it comes down to.
Yeah, I think controls wise, let me think. So you're saying because right now it's like pass and steal. Is one button, so the same button to pass with is what you steal with, and you prefer or you're used to games where it's like you pass with the button and then you switch your play on defense. You switch your player with that pass button.
Yeah.
With the idea being that this is basically your button that changes players, right?
Essentially, yeah.
Defense. Yeah,
and I think it got really bad on Nintendo 64, especially because the Nintendo 64 controller was not really made for sports games. They adapted to it by using the C buttons, which were camera buttons, why they are the C buttons, up, down, left, right. And they adapted to it, but it's very contrived on that controller in particular. But at the same time, because it is a bit of a throwback to older games that did that, I think it works for the concept of Basketball Classics. I mean, if there was an option to switch it around, then I wouldn't object to it, but at the same time, I think it works for that style of gameplay. But with the sim games, and especially that Nintendo 64 era, it aged very badly because you say, okay, which C button is switch player instead of pass? So that's where whereas you've only got the three you've only got the three buttons, so you can figure it out much easier.
Yeah. Growing up, the only controller I hated worse than the N64 one was Jaguar 64-bit. But you can go ahead. That controller was absolutely horrible.
Yeah. I think. Did you have anything else to share about the controls of old games? Because I just think that there was a big learning. You know, that there was like a real awkward. The Nintendo 64 was the most awkward phase. You know. Like, I played Showdown the other day on the 64. It's like, let me open the controls settings, turn everything that's not pass and shoot to turbo. You know, so there's, like, all the other buttons is just turbo. and then this controller now makes sense, you know. It turned into a three-button controller with 12 buttons on it.
Mm-hmm.
So...
The Nintendo 64 games that have aged well, like an Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask and so forth, Conker's Bad Fur Day, the games that have aged well have aged really well. The games that have aged poorly have aged really, really poorly on that system. It's kind of one of those extremes on that system because it's early 3D, so they're still figuring things out. And even a game like Mario 64, which I think is a tremendous game for its time, but I still find myself preferring the 16-bit side-scroller rather than the 3D Marios.
Super Mario, you know, Superman 64 might be the worst game ever made.
No, yeah. Superman.
I'm sorry. I don't think I've ever played a game more frustrating than Superman 64. Right?
If anything needed the Snyder Cut, it's Superman 64. It's just... When's that coming out? Yeah, the recut of Superman 64. Absolutely, yeah.
There is something to be said about controllers, though, because if you look at NBA Courtside 2002, that is actually a really good, like, graphic and animation game, but when you get your hands on the sticks and there's no way to adjust it, it is an absolute nightmare. Like the button placement and everything, it's just that game could have been, it's one of the most frustrating games because it could have been so good, but I mean, you're pulling up from full court because you don't know where the shoot button is, the shot clock's running out because you can't remember where the shoot button is. There's just so many weird things with the control scheme that just ruin that game.
If you're getting 5 second violations off the the start of the game because you don't know where the pass button is and you're trying every part, that's a poorly designed control scheme, basically.
Right. I would have passed it in. I just didn't get to that button yet.
I'm not hogging the ball. I just don't know what button to press.
I would rather play Bill Laimbeer's Combat Basketball over Courtside 2000. Just because I know I understand what I'm doing on the court. I mean, it's not basketball, but I understand.
It's not basketball. Yeah.
And in fact, that's another issue to bring up kids sports basketball again. One of the issues with that is that the passing works like a soccer game in that it doesn't, that you if you're trying to pass diagonally, a lot of the time it's going out of bounds. And there's also, which is another problem, is that there's fouls in this game, but you can also hop up the court with the jump button, so there's no traveling. So they're trying to introduce young kids to the sport of basketball, yet it's mixed rules about what they're actually, you know, there's out of bounds and fouls, but there's no travels. And again, that you pass the ball, most of the passes go out of bounds because, or get intercepted, because the pass kind of goes in the direction of your teammate, and if you can, if the teammate can kind of move into it, if the AI will allow it, then you will catch the pass. So there's no kind, and I know we talk about passes being floaty in modern games, or too contrived, and canned catches, canned interceptions and everything, but it's just done, you kind of have to do that with a basketball game to have, and again, I'm guessing that's something that you also had to work out as well, being able to catch in motion, being able to actually get the pass to players, and also whether you want to have out-of-bounds calls as well in a game like Basketball Classics. And I know you added the backcourt violation, which I think was very important. So it's the what rules do you have in your representation of basketball, and something as simple as mechanics, like can the player catch a pass with regularity when you actually try and pass diagonally? If they're not standing right next to you, can you get your teammate the ball? Can you bring the ball up the court without hopping up the court and traveling? You know, these little things like that, it comes down to like the basics of the mechanics, as we said.
What kind of fast break is it with James Worthy when you try to pass it to him and he's in motion and then he stops to catch the ball?
Yeah.
That's not a fast break. He has to keep going towards the hoop, and some of the older games actually have that.
Yeah,
where they like
yeah.
stop, and it's like, oh, there goes my fast break. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it speaks to like the balance of fun and simulation. I mean, there were a lot of things, you know, like out of bounds, like. Out of bounds isn't really a thing in our game. That was kind of something that we took from NBA Jam because it's just not fun. You know, when it comes down to it, our guiding principle is, does this make the game more fun or not? And so there were a few rules like that that were like, you know, let's just drop it. It doesn't make the game more fun. Tecmo NBA is not fun. Because there are charging fouls every 10 seconds that completely break up the gameplay, and you never know why it's called. I mean, that's one of the main things that drove our design as well, is like the player needs to understand why things happen at every moment. Like, you don't just have random fouls called that were completely out of your control. I mean, I guess that also speaks to, like, you know, the players in charge of their destiny. They need to feel in control.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, and it comes down to that concept that things, and Derek, you touched on this last week, I think, it was, or the week before, when we were talking about PBA Basketball Slam as opposed to Dunk Lords, what works in one game isn't going to necessarily work in another, and there is room for different approaches to virtual basketball. So it comes down to, even though there are some things that perhaps games should have in common with their shooting mechanics or passing or etc., being able to adjust and do things that suit the tone and the style of a game is very important.
Yeah, exactly. You're talking about, you know, commonalities like jump passing. Like, if you make an arcade basketball game or a sim basketball game, jump passing should be standard. You know what I mean? Like, as far as, you know, with PBA Basketball Slam, when it was first released and I gave that feedback, you couldn't jump pass in an arcade game, like NBA Jam. So I couldn't go up for a shot and dump it down and then go up for a dunk, or I couldn't pass out of a dunk and all that stuff. And, so like Andrew said, there are standards that need to be met in control and functionality and stuff. But like you said, like something like out of bounds, having out of bounds, I can guarantee you haven't had one complaint that there's no out of bounds.
Yeah.
Right? Like there hasn't been one. Right. So that was a smart design by you, because who was going to that doesn't need to belong in that type of game.
Yeah. You're not going to get reviews saying, hey, where's the out of bounds? I wanted my pass to not get to my player. I wanted it to go out of bounds.
Exactly.
Why is this game not more complicated? Why doesn't this game suck? I want this game to suck. I want to have to hold the controller upside down, two buttons at once, move both sticks in opposite directions to win the tip. That's what I want. You know?
Listen, I have just, there's too many swishes. I'm getting too many swishes. I don't like seeing the ball after I shoot it. Can you please patch that out? You should have.
There's too much basketball in this basketball classics. Can we make this a hockey game? You know.
Well, 2K21 already has that.
Oh. Shots fired. So we're going to actually put a pin in this discussion here. It's we ran very long with our recording, Derek.
Well, that's nothing new on the MLSC. I mean,
that's true, yeah.
That's a weekly occurrence. So.
But we did go for 3 hours this week. This is around about the hour and a half mark, or that's what I'm aiming to do. We are splitting the show into two this week, so part two will be coming next week, where we're talking more with Josh and Dave about basketball classics, about the games we grew up with, and, of course, what makes a good and bad basketball game. But we've really been enjoying the discussion so far.
Yeah, reminiscent of our two-part NBA Live anniversary episodes where we recorded for around 4 or 5 hours, so we're no stranger to this.
Just think when we get to the Jam It retrospective, the 5 hour show that's going to be.
Oh my god, I can't wait. As long as we can bring up other really bad basketball games in the past, then I'm all for it.
I'm sure we'll find something to fill the time in that regard. We always do. But yes, please stay tuned for episode 2 coming next week. In the meantime, though, we will be wrapping up this episode 342 of the NLC podcast. We thank you for tuning in to part 1. The NLC podcast comes out each and every week, of course, on the NLSC, which is nba-live.com. We're also on various podcatching apps and platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, to name just a few. On those platforms, search for the NLSC podcast, look for our logo, and that will be us. Or keep streaming on the NLSC, of course. As long as you're tuning in each and every week and enjoying the show, that is the main thing. Before I promote our socials, Derek, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at D4384. Also on the NLSC as a contributor, D4-3, YouTube, D4-3 as well. And when you can also find my podcast, Holding Court with D4-3, which we'll be recording episode 6 shortly. That's on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Podcast Addict, and various other podcasting platforms.
Excellent. And sometimes I make appearances there too, where we do our best to disagree with each other, but have some very similar opinions.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's hard to disagree with you about hoop. But, you know, at the same time, I can force it sometimes if people want some drama.
Yes, are we going to be the new Skip and Shannon?
Yeah, someday they'll do an E! True Hollywood story about our relationship. It'll be interesting.
Explosive, even.
yeah, explosive.
I am, of course, on the NLSC. I am Andrew, very creatively named on the NLSC. On Twitter, I am Andrew NLSC. You can connect with me there to follow my opinions and chat with me there about whatever, and respond to what I post about basketball, basketball gaming, wrestling, all the other stuff that I like to fits my hobbies and interests and whatnot. You can follow me there. The NLSC, you can connect with us as well. I encourage you to do so. On Twitter and Facebook, we are the NLSC. On Instagram, we are NLSC Basketball. YouTube is NBA Live Series Center. And of course, keep it locked to the NLSC itself, nba-live.com, for everything we do for basketball video games. But yes, that's all for this week, part one of our chat with Josh and Dave. Until next time, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Derek.
Go get buckets, everyone.